Welcome to Kaput Radio. I'm Martin. We are now involved in perhaps another war in the Middle East, so I chose a rerun of the debate and criticism which we had a few years ago, and also the effects at home in the USA, Britain, and here. Please enjoy a blast from the past with Mark Steele.
I was interested in your comment there that the reasons for the war change almost every day, which they do seem to do, which if there was even a coherent excuse for a war, it ought to be the same coherent lying excuse. Give Blair his due there. He kept up with the same lie. He didn't change it every day. But they get in a pickle with the lies, because one of the reasons, of course, that we went, one of the main reasons, right from the beginning, and they still come up when it's that day of the week that this is the reason, is democracy. We're trying to introduce democracy into Afghanistan, and they're doing this despite the fact that they have gone to the most extraordinary length to install in Afghanistan, as leader, a man who came to be the leader through an election that then immediately had to be rerun because the election was corrupt. And that was the democratically elected leader that they've put in there, to the extent that an organisation called, a human rights group called Transparency International, I know, has published a league table of the world's most corrupt countries, in which Afghanistan came second after Somalia, such is the achievement there so far. And I can't help thinking that Karzai was probably a little bit put out by that and felt that he could have won it, really. And he's probably a bit cross with Somalia and thinks, well, we could have won that if only we bribed the right judges. But that's the achievement on that. Gordon Brown, the beleaguered Gordon Brown, said during the election campaign, when Afghanistan was mentioned as it was so rarely, that when in answer to this charge, that in order to deal with corruption, we seem to have installed a corrupt regime, he said, "We are hoping for some early action on this corruption." Which is, I wonder how early it can be when you've spent 8 years in a war to think, well, in a fairly early stage of the next part of this, part after the 8 years, how on earth is the nonsense of it, the complete incoherence of it? Yes, we are going to deal with the corruption that we're there, that we've installed, having promised to get rid of it in the first place, because it's only been 8 years. You think even a builder, even the worst builder, after 8 years of doing absolutely nothing, if you said, well, are you going to start any point soon, wouldn't say we're going to have one more cup of tea, because we do want to get an early start and we'll only be a few more minutes. This is a completely incoherent, even by poor beleaguered Gordon Brown's standard in those moments. And the people that are underneath Karzai, the Asian Times, there's a report in the Asian Times, US and NATO contingents spend hundreds of millions of dollars annually on Afghan security providers, most of which are local warlords guilty of human rights abuses. So even if you say that this was a war that was in order to install democracy and get rid of the warlords, fair dues, they have got rid of some of the warlords, and they've replaced them with other warlords who are guilty of human rights abuses, but we're now paying hundreds of millions of pounds for them. None of that makes sense. The argument, if you can remember back to when the war first started, that it was the heroin trade. This was the argument that was on the front pages of papers and came out of the politicians' mouths, both in Britain and America, almost every day. If you were against it, don't you care about the heroin? What about the heroin? If you don't care about anything else, what about that? There's now three times the production of opium that there was at the time. So again, an extraordinary achievement there. And of course, one of the ones that every now and again they come up with when they get a bit flustered, as they did at the beginning, women's rights. We're aiming to introduce women's rights. That's what our role is out there in the Middle East. That's what we're particularly proud of. And always think, you, of course, yes, because that is what we do. We can't stand a country that is so appalling on women's rights. That's why we only sell hundreds of millions of dollars worth of arms every year to feminist countries like Saudi Arabia, where you can barely walk through the streets of Riyadh without being sold a Virago book. Every one of the arguments makes so little sense. The idea of terrorism being the reason. So many ridiculous flaws in that argument. The 7/7 bombers came from Leeds. Are they next? This is all the inquiries that are coming out about Iraq from senior people in the intelligence say that in Iraq, it clearly made the threat of terrorism in this country far, far more serious, which is something that, all right, they now say that, but of course anyone with any sense who paid a fleeting glance to the situation knows that that was absolutely the case. And yet, all of these things now that come out of these sort of leaks that have come out that Lindsay was referring to today, again, the incoherence of their arguments, that they say, well, I know it's one of the, just saying this in the news before I was coming out, the argument seems to be, but these civilian casualties that we were that are being talked about, they were about 4 or 5 years ago. They've stopped now. This was a report that was about 4 or 5 years ago. If only the report had come out a year later, if only these leaks dealt with a slightly later period, we'd put a stop, as if it was just some sort of bureaucratic error. We forgot to keep killing civilians, but we put that right. Of course it's a nonsense. And if there is one document, if you like, that wasn't just leaked, but that is official, that really tells you, I think, why these civilian casualties get killed and why it's not just a matter of a mistake here and an error there and the wrong bit of paper being filled in, or they forgot to tick the box that said, we don't want civilian casualties. The Savile inquiry, there was one little passage in that that I think was so important because it was about so much more than Northern Ireland, where it talked about how, in that situation, the soldiers started to see every civilian in the area as a potential terrorist, as part of the enemy. And of course that's the case. Of course, when you're an occupying army that becomes more and more unpopular, of course that's the case. Everybody is a potential enemy, everyone's a potential threat, they don't want you there, and so everybody therefore is liable to end up on this list of civilian casualties, whether or not that gets leaked. All of that is the case. And yet, Lindsay said so much opposition to it, so brilliant that the people like Joe Glenton, it's an extraordinary courageous thing that he did, Joe. And yet, the way that the way that he's dealt with, put in jail for this, what that means now in this peculiar country, it means that if you tell the truth to try to stop a war, you are put in jail. However, if you tell a series of lies in order to try and start a war, then 7 years later you'll be called for 5 minutes for an inquiry and then let go to make millions of pounds speaking around the world. Incoherence of it, the idea we have to jail people like Joe Glenton as a warning to other people, or what is it? What is it? Because he's a threat to society? I mean, if we let him roam around without putting him in jail, he might have gone and done it again. He might have refused to serve in all other sorts of wars, and then where we would be? The public wouldn't be safe. There's no sense at all. I always think it must be peculiar for him in a way. When he joined the army and said he was going to Afghanistan, he must have thought, well, you know, there is a fair chance that as a result of this I could end up in captivity, and I don't suppose it ever occurred to him that that would be because he'd be jailed by the British Army. Of course, when they talk about it, so it tells you so much about the role of the army in Afghanistan and the role of the British Army in recent years as well. When you look at the reasons why Joe was jailed, because you're not supposed to have an opinion. But of course that's not the case. We see soldiers interviewed on the television fairly regularly. The soldiers that say, for whatever reasons, that they think that the war is being won, although it's increasingly hard, I would imagine, to find those sorts of soldiers. But you do hear those. You do hear people, very senior people in the army, such as one that went off to support the Conservatives, saying that he thought the war in Afghanistan could be won. And it seems that you are allowed to have an opinion in the army, as long as it's the one that they want you to have. The opinion you're not allowed to have is the one that is staringly obvious because it's blindingly obvious because you see it every day. Presumably they're not allowed to notice things. Otherwise it might lead them to having an opinion. They're not allowed to notice people don't like them and don't want them being there. They're not allowed to notice that they're actually creating rather than preventing future terrorist threats. So the opinions are only one way. But that does leave the reason, just too quickly, very quickly, I suppose, it does leave us wanting to know what the reason is why they're there. And I think one of the amazing things of this, part of it's accident, isn't it, that George Bush and his people at the time this war started had a plan. All those things that seem extraordinary now because they all, at least the names, are done away with, the full spectrum dominance and the project for the new American century and so on, and all these sort of macabre and sinister plans that people like Rumsfeld that are so happily forgotten now. But all of these people had that plan. But I think, as Lindsay said, they're now very embarrassed about the fact that this isn't working. And they're certainly unsure about how they can get out of it without making it look as if they're going to lose face. That's what the main aim now of is the war. Oh dear, we mustn't lose face. We must carry on killing these civilians, whether or not it gets leaked that that's happening. We must carry on with British soldiers being killed in order that the people that are at the top of society in a few countries that are prosecuting this war don't lose face. And that's why I think for our side it's so crucial to realise, when we think this through, that it's not true that nothing is changing on our side. It could seem like that when you come to the same place and there's much the same people here and so on. You think, is anything changing? And yet when you think about how the last 5 or 6 years has gone, it has changed enormously. Whatever you think of Obama, and of course there are, you know, many, many reasons to have enormous reservations about Obama, but even so, I think it would have seemed extraordinary 18 months before he was elected that it would have been possible for there to be a president elected in America who consistently said that he campaigned against the Iraq war, which he did. Now, that's an extraordinary... Whatever you think about Obama's reservations and how he's let a lot of people down and so on, nonetheless, that is an extraordinary change that took place. And it took place because millions of people around the world, inspired by the hundreds of people who met in rooms like this and did all the things that campaigners do, started to change the mood and change the tide, and with all the letters that were written to the papers and all the demonstrations that felt as if they might not be working and so on, and there must have been many, many times when all of us have gone on things and think, did that really make any discernible difference to the world? And yet, bit by bit, all of these little things and all of the little protests and the tiny little things that people do have combined to make up one huge movement that around the world means that now there is a consensus, really, obviously not a total consensus, not a unanimous one, but there is a growing consensus that the war is wrong and that it has to be got rid of. And I think the world is a very, very different place now than it would have been if no one had campaigned. They almost certainly would have bombed Iran by now, but for the fact that the millions of people that around the world campaigned and argued and protested and made whatever gesture they could to say that we don't want this. I mean, I was amazed a few months ago when Salma Yacoub was on Question Time, BBC One's Question Time, and in Wootton Bassett. Now, there's a tough gig, right? You are a Muslim woman, anti-war campaigner in Wootton Bassett. It's almost like one of these dreams you have where you think, oh, no, how could that happen? And she was in there, and partly because of her own prowess, which is considerable, but also because the mood is there for this to happen, then she was able to win over the crowd to her way of thinking. I don't think there's an enormous gap between the people who are sort of lining the streets in Wootton Bassett and the opinions of people who are against the war. We're after the same things, which is less deaths for no apparent reason after all. And for that reason, I think surely we have to go on campaigning against the war, firstly because that's the right thing to do, but also because we are, bit by bit, making a huge difference.
Thanks very much, and thanks to everyone so far. I thought Frances was going to get carried away when she got you all stood up and linking arms and suddenly discovered an anarchist streak and we were all going to go out into the street and destroy the House of Commons. But that's what they wanted, Frances. This has come together, I suppose, because it's become more and more obvious that there is an idea that's dominating the way the country is run. The government runs the country, it seems, with this idea that there is so much debt now. Debt, 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 debt. We've got to get all the debt back. And there's only one group of people that's clearly have got the money that we can get the debt back from. It's the poor. The poor have got all the money in this country, so it only stands to reason that they're the people we can get it back from. Because Because it's now, it seems to me, I've never done economics, but it seems to me that mainstream economics now, the first lesson is that the poor are richer than the rich. And not only that, but they're the ones that caused the banking crisis, the poor. The rich couldn't cause it, it was nothing to do with them, it was the poor. It was lollipop ladies and firefighters and teachers and people in A&E lying on trolleys and then waking up out of their coma for 10 minutes to speculate £500 million on the yen, losing all the money. So... It just makes perfect sense that these bastards who've been robbing us, that they have their trolleys taken off them, and they have their schools shut down, and that they're told that they can't have a bedroom that happens to be the end of their house, that nobody is in it for a few hours a day. Because these are the people, you can't expect the rich. The rich haven't got two apes to rub together, we know that. They're spending all day in the stock market, and then they're having to spend the evenings delivering Domino's pizzas to make ends meet. You can't expect them to pay for it. It's the poor. The poor who's got all the money. And that's why, if you get... I'm very grateful to the Daily Mail, because I have to write a column every week where I have to try and take the piss out of ridiculous, stupid, maniacal things that people say. And the Daily Mail always helps me out. And... And if you get the Daily Mail, you will see, exactly as Owen was saying, trying to blame each other, the poor, the someone poorer, it's their fault. Every week a story. You see this woman in a council estate who's on benefits, and she's got 185 kids, and every single one of them's on benefits, and then they bought a giraffe, and now the giraffe's on benefits. And then she complained because the giraffe was getting a crick neck because the ceiling was too low, so they put her up in St. Paul's Cathedral, And now she says all the kids have got compulsive snooker syndrome, so the town hall has come round and delivered a snooker table, but the woman says she can't be the referee because she's allergic to white gloves, so the mayor has to come round and count up all the points, otherwise we'll be put in jail by Europe, and so on, and so on. And the excuses, and this is partly the fault of the fact that there hasn't been a coherent alternative voice that's put itself in the mainstream, the excuses that they think they can get away with. Lord Jones, who was head of the Confederation of British Industry, when he was talking about yet more bankers' bonuses, $7 billion a year in bankers' bonuses after the crash, after you've buggered everything up, you then still go, well, we've still got to have our $7 billion a year. And Lord Jones justified this. He said, well, in the year that the bankers' bonuses went down slightly, they received not one jot of praise. Heartless. We're heartless. We don't praise them for their... It's like saying the great train robbers, we all complain about the year they did do a train robbery, but all the years they didn't rob a train, they received not one jot of praise. And so... Ever more inventive are the genius pieces of cruelty that they come up with. The bedroom tax. What warped mind came up with this? To decide that the poorest people, if there's a little bit of a house... And so we can't possibly have a mansion tax, George Osborne said. And this was his reasoning. He said we can't have a mansion tax because it would be extraordinarily difficult to calculate. Because the mansion tax would be for properties worth more than £2 million. And I could see that would be very, very difficult. If you go around most council estates, you'd have to have someone with a clipboard going around each one individually to see whether each flat was worth more than £2 million. But you'd never know. Maybe Picasso painted the walls. You don't know. And so this piece of cruelty goes on. And yet, there is something, I think, that we should remember all the time. We're not helpless. Even up until now, the voice against it hasn't been helpless. Just for example, the words the bedroom tax. They hate it. They didn't want it to be called the bedroom tax, but so many people have complained and protested about it, have written about it. Now in almost every area, I travel around the country and you see the local papers, in almost every paper, every week in the local areas, there's people complaining about the bedroom tax, and there's various people highlighted who are going to be particularly hit by it. And the government and the people who came up with it hated it. They thought that they would just be able to get away with calling it, I can't remember what they were supposed to call it, so much of a failure has it been. various campaigns around the country, the magnificent demonstrations in South London to try and defend the accident emergency unit in Lewisham. Fantastic. It didn't succeed, but it didn't entirely fail either, because the government, the local authorities, they had to say, well, we are going to protect some of it and so on. It's one thing that you can never say exactly what what would have happened in the other universe where there was no protest. But what you can say is if there had been no protest, it would have been much worse. And that is the same around the country over and over again. And I think that is the thing that we can all remember, that even up until now, the protests that there are, every little complaint that there is, means that it's better for our side and worse for their side than if there was nothing. And that's why also, something else I think that we should remember over the course of the day. I mean, because it's been a long time really coming this, 3 years into this government that's done the most outrageous things, so many protests. At last, I think there is a real hopeful chance from today that we're going to be bringing the protests together, that we're going to be putting them into some sort of united, coherent world in which we are able to project a voice to say to lots more people, there is an alternative and it is worth joining it, and if you join it, then we can win. And just two final things I'll say about that. One thing is that we do have to, I mean, you think of the brilliant, compassionate, talented people that are on our side. We ought to be able to make ourselves look attractive. Sometimes in the past, the left hasn't always done that, if we're being honest. And I think this is a brilliant opportunity now to change some of the habits over the last few years. I would hope that today there's not going to be the thing. I think everyone's going to go away thinking, what's a fantastic day, because we need to be together. And if you listen, I mean, it's only the left that's done this in the past. You listen to someone for an hour, you think, I agreed with 59 minutes and 50 seconds of what they say. So I know what I'll do. I'll spend the next 5 weeks having a row with them about the 10 seconds. And the way I'll do it is I'll go down to a meeting where they're speaking at and I'll yell at them. That might persuade them and bring them round. I think those days are gone. And the final thing I'll say, very final thing I'll say is this. It is said that in politics you can't win unless you win over the middle ground. This is something that politicians and journalists and people that seem to know about how politics works, they all agree on that. And maybe there is something in that, I don't know. But what they don't say is that the middle ground changes. The middle ground doesn't stay the same from one year to the next. Just one quick example. 20 years ago, if you were in favour of gay marriage, you were considered an extremist. Now, quite rightly, you're considered an extremist if you're against it. It's changed. And it's not changed. And it's not changed automatically. It's changed because first hundreds, then thousands, then tens of thousands, and now millions of people, bit by bit, stood up, often in very difficult circumstances, very courageously, and said, I don't care if I'm in a minority, I'm going to put this case and stand up for what is right. And I think this is the beginning now of people putting an alternative, coherent voice to the filth that comes out of the people at the top of society, so that we can make the middle ground. We can make the middle ground what is quite clearly the middle ground, that when people are poor and desperate and vulnerable and they have done nothing whatsoever to cause chaos in the society, that they should not be the people who are blamed and lambasted and impoverished because of it. That ought to be the middle ground. That they are the extremists. But they are the extremists that cutting schools and hospitals and fire stations and cutting rights for the disabled, that is extreme. What we are supporting is the middle ground. And one day, I'm sure, just as gay marriage now seems like eminently sensible to anyone who is eminently sensible, similarly, people will look back on the period of austerity and say, what the bloody hell were those maniacs doing?
After this review with Mark Steele, it is worth hearing some voices of the War on Terror round number 3.
By all means, let Australians who want to say stupid things say stupid things. That's what I want to see in place very, very swiftly. We are changing the law that will make it easier to say stupid things. Before that even, say stupid things, promote terrorism. These preachers of hate.
Now, of course, it is absolutely right that we should learn the lessons of the past, especially what happened in Iraq a decade ago. But we have to learn the right lessons. But we must not be so frozen with fear that we don't do anything at all. We should be comprehensive, defeating the ideology of extremism that is the root cause of this terrorism.
You are creating the ideology of extremism. They know that. They're not stupid. They like extreme ideologies because they like us being frightened, because when we're frightened of ISIS, we're not thinking, and what about what's going on in this country? What about why are we not housing people? Why are we not spending money on hospitals? They know.
Along with our European partners, we've already been supplying equipment directly to Kurdish forces.
Good idea. Get ready for a story in 2 years. Kurdish rebels are attacking. We have to get these Kurdish terrorists. They're total bastards. We don't know where they got these weapons or why they're such bastards, but get them we must in the battle of ideas against Kurds.
Iran should also be given the chance to show it can be part of the solution, not part of the problem.
Yeah. Order. The question is the motion on Iraq, coalition against ISIL, as on the order paper.
This is always good when you see...
As many as are that opinion say aye.
Aye! Look at what the House of Commons agreed to. Iraq, Afghanistan, in this government, Libya, none are success stories. Are we going to embark on action that could last for years?
This will not be solved. Every matter will be made worse. Extremism will spread further and deeper around the world, just like happened as a result of the last Iraq war. The last people who should be returning to the scene of their former crimes are Britain, France, and the United States of America.
Order.
Let me tell you what I am outraged by.
So you won't even answer that question.
Are you going to allow
me to answer the question?
Are you going to allow me to answer the question?
If you wanted a one-way discussion, which you have obviously come here knowing you didn't want to answer. Does that justify beheading? Does that justify the slaughter of innocents?
Why don't you condemn what the Australian government is doing? Why don't you condemn what the American government is doing? Why don't you condemn the innocent killing of a million lives in Iraq and Afghanistan? Why don't you do that?
I regard it as un-Australian, frankly. I do regard it as un-Australian to fly combat air patrols and strike missions. Our Super Hornet strike fighters are there to fly combat air patrols. We've also got up to 200 special forces there and to protect the wider world. And
okay, you heard from the top Mark Steele, then some news media, and an excerpt of Russell Brand's Truths, episode 157. Thank you for listening to Kaput Radio. I'm Martin, and I'll catch you again with another episode of Kaput Radio.